The Prince of Pain surveys his kingdom. Yeah, I know it doesn't quite scan logically, but go with it. We're talking with Richard Lewis on this episode of Mighty Movie Podcast. Hey, I'm Dan Persons. Welcome to MMP. We're back! And we've got a good reason for coming back. This is special. Richard Lewis is our guest. The great comedian, the great actor. One of the highlights as a regular on Curb Your Enthusiasm, shouldering the whims of Larry David. Also the star of the TV series Anything But Love, where he co-starred with Jamie Lee Curtis, plus lots of other stuff. You may remember him from Leaving Las Vegas. You've seen him a lot. You know him. You love him. He's got a new DVD collection out now. It's called Richard Lewis, Bundle of Nerves. You get it? You get it? It is a two-disc set. It's got some great stuff on it. One of his HBO specials, The Magical Misery Tour, which is new to disc. It's got a bonus feature called House of a Lifetime, in which Lewis takes us through all the stuff he's collected in his career, photos, memorabilia, stuff like that. Each piece has a story, not surprisingly, and Lewis obliges us with those stories. But for the purposes of our discussion, this set also has the home video debut of two films. Diary of a Young Comic from 1977, which was Lewis's acting debut, although not far from his comedy persona, since he's playing a comedian who transplants himself from New York to LA, and in his quest for success discovers the importance of being true to oneself. This is why you'll never see Richard Lewis prop comedian, by the way. The film was directed by Gary Weiss, who did short films for Saturday Night Live during its early seasons. And this was produced by Lorne Michaels, as a matter of fact, and actually debuted as a special in the SNL time slot. It's an interesting little time capsule all the way around, lots of unusual LA flavor. It's funny, too, by the way. And the other film here is in stark contrast pretty much to everything you know about Richard Lewis if you know him only as a funny guy. It's called Drunks from 1995, and Lewis headlines a cast that includes Sam Rockwell, Amanda Plummer, Parker Posey, Spalding Gray, Diane Wiest, Faye Dunaway, for Christ's sake, and Lewis is playing an alcoholic at an AA meeting whose personal unburdening leads him into some dark and dangerous territories. It's a revelatory performance sparked by Lewis's own struggle with alcoholism, and it's really worth seeing. So, we're going to get to the interview, but because of the specialness of this, I'm going to do something I've never done before. I'm giving you the complete conversation from beginning to end. Usually the way I do this stuff is that I connect with the interview subject on Skype, we exchange a few pleasantries, and then we begin the formal interview, and that's usually at the point I start what I give you on these podcasts. But this is Richard Lewis, and the dance is different with him, and you're going to hear me playing catch-up at places with him, because his mind does move that fast. There's also some awkwardness on my side at the beginning and end. I'm playing in a different league with him, clearly. But it's worth it to give you everything that he did give me. So, this is my full experience with Richard Lewis. It all starts when I answer the phone.
Hello?
Dan.
Hi, Richard.
Richard Lewis.
Yeah,
how are you? Are you are you with relatives?
With relatives? No.
you sounded tentative when you answered. I thought maybe they forced you to call for a family reunion.
Oh, I've got so many doubts these days, Richard. You don't know. So
many what?
Doubts.
about everything.
Yeah, really, seriously.
I know. Me too, Ben. I've had them ever since I've been in the womb, my friend. I was a psychic. It wasn't just the arguing. I overheard the television news. So anyway, Dan Persons. What a name. Dan Persons, Private Eye.
Thank you.
You know that, don't you? Congratulations on your name. You're already ahead of the game. Over 90% of the world's population, they got crap names. Not you. So you're stuck with a great name, so you should be grateful.
All right,
that's it. Show's over.
That's it. Thanks a lot, Richard. It was great talking with you.
Listen, I hope you got what you want. I'm all ears. I'm all fears, and I'm ready to just jump into anything you have to ask me. I'm practically fearless.
Okay. Just so you know, the recorder is already running, so, you know.
That's good.
Okay,
that's
fine. Fine.
When can my therapist hear this interview?
We can get the transcript to you within 24 hours, so.
Well, it'll be a transcript, huh?
Yes, for a nominal fee, of course.
Of course. All right, so I better watch out what I say. This is, you got it. Not that I care.
It's all on the record. It's all on the record.
I know.
Okay. So, we did. So, we're going to be talking about Bundle of Nerves. Bundle of Nerves, this new disc set you got.
Right.
I wanted to
ask. A lot of stuff going on. Go on, ask. I'll shut up.
Please.
I was always wrong growing up, so I have trouble shutting up, but I will. I'm a good person today.
It's a real.
I'm brimming with self confidence for some reason. It's shaky.
Okay, I got you at a good time then.
Yeah, perhaps. So go on. I'm sorry, Dan.
No, it's okay. It's the nature of Skype. Would that we could I be interviewing you in person? Then everything would be going a lot smoother.
I think it's a superlative interview. You've gotten tremendous amounts of information out of me thus far.
Okay.
Okay, go on. I'm ready. I'm ready for one question.
Okay.
I put on a suit.
You dressed up, which is more than I can say.
I'm very respectful of the press.
All right, thank you. I'm flattered. You're giving me more due than I deserve, probably.
Well, it's only one suit I've had. I've been dragging around with me for four decades. It doesn't look that good, but it's the media suit. Okay, what's the question, Dan?
Okay,
I'm afraid.
I wanted to ask you. This was something that you brought up in your audio commentary for Diary of a Young Comic, and you also bring it up during House of a Lifetime, that video tour of all the stuff you've collected. You have a deep interest in Buster Keaton, don't you?
Very large interest. Mm-hmm. Do you want me to take off from there, or
let me just ask you.
If I just say yes, wouldn't that be? Why don't you just throw me into subject jail? Yes, I do. Next.
Okay.
I'm going to take a fifth.
Moving on.
There is a story, but nothing.
Well, what I do want to know is how you got interested in him. How did you get introduced to him, and what of his work speaks to you?
Okay, that's quick. My father, rest his soul, about a year before he passed on, I was still at The Ohio State University. I had one quarter to go. I was hanging on for a fifth year, and I wanted to stay there for the rest of my life, but it didn't work out. But he gave me this $5 a day kind of Europe, and unfortunately I didn't know how to travel, but I went to about 16 countries, like 10 weeks. It was really, I sort of minored in art history somewhat. And so it was just surreal going to every museum I could see and in the countries I was at. And so I wound up exhausted in London for the last 9 days of the trip. And I was just walking around and I saw a Buster Keaton Festival. And I had seen bits and pieces of Keaton, but unbeknownst to me, right around that time in 69 or 68, maybe a little earlier, this guy found all of Keaton's films and James Mason's mansion, which was Buster Keaton's in the 20s, in the wine cellar or something. And this great guy, took all of the films and remastered them. So then all of the films were restored. I had no idea about any of the stuff at 19 or 20. And I sat in the huge theater that had an organ player. It was full. It was absolutely jam-packed. Lots of students. And I was overwhelmed by this guy's genius, his filmmaking, his persona. His persona immediately hooked to me because I was, already a fledgling anxiety addict. And so here's this guy, the great stone face, in the middle of any possible kind of, bad condition, just seemed so stoic and so cool. I was smitten by the guy. And as a film buff back then, certainly, I was astonished at all these first time shots that he would do and the setups and the filmmaking was extraordinary. He had everything that I ever wanted and the laughs. And he was such a cool guy. And so one film that spoke to me most was Steamboat Bill Jr., mm-hmm. Which had a father and son's story arc. And, Buster played this sort of East Coast preppy mm-hmm. kind of character from college and comes back to visit his father, who owns it's a real rough, tough guy like Bluto, and mm-hmm. he tries to win the love of his father. And quickly, my dad was like bigger than life to me, just like this guy was. He wasn't as gruff for sure, but he still wanted the love from his father. And, as the years moved on, and I realized, that my father never was around when I even was a comedian, the movie has taken on different meanings to me. Every time I see it now, it's hard for me not to say, God, I wish my father was around to see some of the stuff and meet some of the, people that he loved, even like growing up. I'm not growing up, but we watch things together, like whether it's Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks or Sid Caesar, the list is endless, who become friends of mine. It just would have been a thrill to have introduced my father to all of these people, or at least a majority of them. I don't know if they would hung out with the Stones, but, he would have gone to Sid Caesar's house, or Mel Brooks's house in a flash. So that's my, ultimately the topper is that I became really close with Buster Keaton's widow, Eleanor, and because I did a biography and I was one of the guests on the film. And I did an AMC tribute to Keaton. Anyway, I met Eleanor. She came over to my house, and she met my wife, Joyce, and we walked around. She saw all the memorabilia, I took her out to dinner the first time, and I called a hotel, and I said, you better treat her like a queen, because she's absolutely the greatest, to me. And so they treated her like a goddess, and it was just, it was just thrilling. I was very nervous when I was alone with her at dinner because I had so many questions, but I didn't know if I was going to be invasive. But she really warmed up. I asked her about one thing in particular. I remember that I just to get it going. I'm like, hey, in Limelight, Chaplin's film, when he shared the screen for the first time with Keaton, how did Charlie? What was the day like? Well, how did Charlie treat Buster? And it was really nice to hear that Chaplin and Buster had long out of the limelight for himself. Other than TV stuff and commercials, he said that Chaplin treated him like the god, paraphrasing, but like the god he was cinematically. So it was beautiful that Chaplin did that. And I take her at her word for sure because she was there.
It's interesting because coming from the film world, I sort of feel like there are certain levels to appreciation of film comedy. It's like, at the broader public level, you're sort of like at Adam Sandler and Will Ferrell and like that. And once you get into that, you discover Charlie Chaplin. And then I think the next level is Buster Keaton. And that's sort of where you become open to the sophistication of film comedy. It's like, and it's not to diminish Chaplin in any way, but it's like Chaplin is the poet and Keaton is more like a scientist of comedy.
I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that at all. I mean, I mean, just if you just isolate his stunts alone, it was very scientific and oftentimes just, you know, death-defying. But I could see it, and I can put those two like that. You know, it was always interesting enough. It was like I was so enamored with Keaton's work that, and I had fallen down on some of the Chaplin specials. I mean, not specials, God specials, imagine films. And I said to myself, I was like the Beatles and the Stones for me. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. who do I like? You know, growing up, you know, Beatles or Stones. And to me, it was like, I went out of my way not to see some Chaplin films for like the longest time, for like a child, you know. Finally, I took a month off and I just caught up on some things that I wanted to, address filmically, you know. And so, yeah, I mean, look, it's there, you know, these are the things that, and one of the reasons I put that a house of a lifetime, you know, before we get out of this home and move elsewhere, is that guy, you know, Keaton and people like that, and well, anyone in the arts. I mean, I got married very late in life, so my family were iconic people in the arts. Of course, you know, the trip is that I met many of them, which is, you know, still surreal to me. Mm-hmm. I might be a celebrity, but I don't consider myself, or I consider myself someone who wants to express himself on stage and you know, literally just make people laugh. And and I have passion about the craft. That's it. You know, the celebrity just comes along with it. And I have no, you know, it's the last thing I care about, to be quite frank. But, you know, to be able to enjoy, you know, like the visual stuff that you can see in that little sort of short documentary, is that, you know, and there's so much that you couldn't see in that time, but, you know, whether it's the, and I tried to get the moments, some moments, like, you know, I remember as 13 or 14, I was living in New Jersey then with my family, and I took some friends. We went across the George Washington Bridge. We took went down to Times Square, and we wanted to see the Kubrick film, with Sellers and Dr. Strangelove. And, I remember I was a teenager, and when the film ended, you know, yahoo, it was going down that bomb, and the movie over, and it exploded into a beautiful song, and I just knew. I mean, I understood as much of the movie as I could, and you know, I didn't know everything, certainly at 13 or 14, God knows, but I knew that I was in the presence of an artist, Kubrick, that whatever this craft, this filmmaking, whatever this guy did, it is a high bar. And, you know, and I went through my teens feeling that way about comedians, about dramatists, you know, filmmakers, you know, artists. You know, I just knew, I hardly was an expert on in any of these areas. I'll say hardly, but I knew when I was watching something or looking at a painting or hearing, you know, hearing Miles Davis or anything like that. It turns out I was right most of the time because my house had been populated with images of these people that, you know, had an impact on me. And the older I got, the more I found out about these iconic artists, and I would buy a lot of images just to, you know, because I was basically, you know, a single guy till I was 57. My family were these images, so that's one of the reasons I wanted to do that film, Charlie Rifkin directed, a terrific young director. And so that's that. I'm wandering here, so.
No, that's okay. That's okay. We're sort of covering everything here. I did want to talk to you about the two actual films on this set, Diary of a Young Comic and Drunks.
Trip.
You know, and first off, Diary of a Young Comic was your debut as playing in a narrative film, not doing stand up.
Except till the very end, yeah.
Yeah. That's true. There is the sequence at the end. But even so, I mean, at that point, were you directed towards the goal of becoming an actor?
At that time?
Yes.
Was I directed toward the goal?
Or what was that one of your goals?
No. Not at all. I was only about 7 years, not even. I hit the stage in 71, you know, middle of the year. So I was a comic about 6 years. And I was thinking about, and at that time I'd already done The Tonight Show 4 years prior. I hit that, you know, hit the tube pretty fast, I would say. About 2.5 years, and I was starting to do talk shows, which was cool, but I was just all immersed. I had, you know, tunnel vision for stand-up. That's all. I lived and read that stand-up comedy. I was searching for more and more of authenticity, and that came with being more fearless as best I could, and as honest as I could. I actually treated audiences like I would be in various psychotherapists I've had through the years. And I always figured, and even during my, when I wasn't sober, which was 20 years now, I always felt, if particularly with the last therapist, which is still, she's still hanging on with me when I go, I said, if I go to her, no matter, and I wasn't a bad guy, you know, but I didn't have a lot of sick stuff or dark secrets, but I said, you know, anything that made me feel really ill at ease about myself, I had to share with this woman. I told her everything that made me uncomfortable, anything that I felt was unscrupulous. And when I left, I always felt great. So, so the audience to me, every night I go on, when I go on, whether it's a club or a concert hall, I basically just want get it off my chest, and it comes out, hopefully, most of the time, humorously. I mean, otherwise, you know, they can cart me away, you know, just I'd be ranting. And sometimes people think that in an audience, what the hell is he doing? You know, I sort of feel like the Cassavetes of stand-up sometimes. Pardon me for being, I don't mean to be grandiose, but, you know, I never went out to get a wide swath of humanity with my humor. I mean, it's very selective, and if I may say, and the people that have followed me for over 40 years, and certainly the last 20 years, they discovered me on Curb Your Enthusiasm, which premiered in 2000, you know, and then they go back and see some stuff and come see me live, and they'll realize that I'm basically the same guy on stage as I am off. And for some people, that's really cool. For some people, they go, I don't get it, and I don't care, you know. But the truth is, Diary, when Bennett Tramer, who was a terrific writer back then, brought in Gary Weiss, who was doing a lot of films for SNL, you know, they got Lorne Michaels wanted Gary to do a full length thing, not just a small film, and he was friends with Bennett Tramer, the co-writer ultimately with this film with me, and he says, I think I know the guy, and he brought him in to see me, and he said, that's the guy, and I said, I'll do this only if I can co-write it. And then Ben and I, basically the premise became, long story short, how do you find your authenticity? It was exactly the life I was leading. I moved to New York. I went to L.A. I threw myself into it. And, of course, it became really, you know, episodic and funny. We wanted to say how much crap there was to overcome obstacles in show business, plus to show that this guy was on a journey, and ultimately, you know, the best he could be was to talk about his life, which was going back to the film. And then he goes on stage and talks about some of the interesting episodes he had in life up to that point in L.A. So, you know, it was an important little statement. And a lot of comics, you know, through the decades have come over to me and said, oh, my God, I was only in junior high school, and this thing just popped on, because it was a trip. You know, in 79, I was, you know, sort of the early heyday for SNL, and all of a sudden, without any, you know, there was some couple of commercials before, you know, promoting it, but not much. And all of a sudden, I pop on at 11:30, man. That was a big hit, and, I mean, for me. And it got really good press, and I remember someone sent me a double spread by Shales in the Washington Post. I mean, the next day it was really cool. And that night we all went to Cantor's, a famous 24-hour deli, and all these comics came. It was really a high point for me. I was there with my former girlfriend, which was a trip in itself, and Baroness Nina Van Pallet, and I still love her. And, you know, she was, I was so young. But we were together. She's in the film as well, in a little scene. I think some of the references I made, she had no clue, being from Denmark, but she played along. And we went to canters with Bennett and his author wife, Sonia. And then Robin came to join us. Robin Williams, bless his soul, man. I mean, I'm not even trying to... You can ask me anything you want about the Reverend, as I called him. He called me the Rabbi, but he came. He was so exhilarated. He was in the middle of doing work, and he was so exhilarated about this. You know, it was like 2 a.m. All these comics are there. He got on top of my table and did like about an hour, man. It was like just real loving back then. You know, there weren't as many comedians. And it was, it was competitive, but, you know, at that point, it was like those who started together, generally speaking, rallied for each other and were thrilled for each other because we were all starting to make we're making a living at what we dreamt we could make a living at. So it was a great deal for me all the way around. And I was really pleased that Jonathan Gross, who runs this company, putting this out, was one of the projects he wanted in there in a big way. And the other two projects were similarly important to him that should be out on DVD. If you want to ask me about any of those, Trunks and Magical Misery Tour.
Yeah, let me do that as well. Let me just point out when we had set this up, we had agreed to like 20 minutes, which we've hit at this point. Are you still good?
I'm real good, yeah.
Okay.
I feel fine if that's all right with you. I'm sorry for rambling.
Oh, no.
I can't talk in sound bites. Never did.
That's fine. That's perfect. That's what this is about. I did want to explore Drunks with you. I almost got the feeling that really the... And maybe this is true specifically for you, that the set... as a whole was really a way of getting Drunks out there and getting attention to that particular film. Is that true?
Well, like all of them, yeah, absolutely, because it got sidetracked. It came out and got, you know, really some great press for people. And, you know, and I may say that, you know, the cast is extraordinary, forget me. But, you know, some of the monologues are legendary and, young actors and actresses use this film. It's like a primer, really. You know, some of these, Diane Weiss, and the list is endless, you know, Dunaway and Howard Rollins, man, it's like the plumber. It's just endless. And these people, their monologues, just rip your guts out. And, you know, how it passed on. But, yeah, the deal is, we wanted to get it out. I always wanted to get it out more. It was niche fast on DVD, but then it wasn't, I think, show business. You know, it got tangled up in all sorts of crap. And I was frustrated about it because for two reasons. One, you know, it was a dramatic role. You know, I won the role. I auditioned. I got it. You know, in front of a lot of people wanted it. You know, and there I was. You know, Richard Lewis. It was like, it wasn't like the crazy neurotic guy. You know, I mean, this guy had some characterizations of who I am, but not anywhere near who I am in real life. You know, at least not anymore. And I had the opportunity, because about 6 months prior to Diary, I mean, prior to this movie, I did the first scene in Leaving Las Vegas. And I remember because I was doing a Letterman show, and Mike Figgis called me, tracked me down. He says, Nick and I want you to do this scene. I said, whoa. I said, they sent me the script. And I went, I literally knew. I said, oh my God, what a script. I said, if Cage pulls this off, he's going to get nominated for an Oscar, and he won, and nominated, of course. And I'm sitting outside of a restaurant in Los Angeles, like about 15 minutes from my home, where they shot Four Vegas. It was being shot for Los Angeles, but title, Leaving Las Vegas. I remember one of my many managers through the years called me and said, how's Vegas? I went, no. I'm 3 blocks from your office, but not Vegas. We're shooting on location in a restaurant interior. You know, that's what talent has to go through sometimes. But I've seen Cage. We did the scene and we're outside. They're setting up for, another setup. And I'm seeing him with some kind of almost like an alcoholic wrangler, you know, saying that now, how do you think, you know, he was going over different types of alcoholism and how it would manifest in certain scenes, and going over the next day's shoot. And I said, God, if I only had an opportunity to play a drunk, because I was sober about 6 months. And lo and behold, I auditioned for Drunks about 4 months later, and I get it. And I just felt, wow, what a break. What a break. You know, Peter Cullen gave me a tremendous break. I just couldn't believe it. That's the deal. And when I went to New York and went to my old hotel, I took everything out of this loop. I said, get me the worst room in the hotel, because I needed a place that I felt safe in. And they took everything out except like just the drawers and the closet they couldn't rip out and the bed. And because this guy was, you know, kind of was going out and using again, and he was fucked up. So I just put a picture of Lenny Bruce and Jimi Hendrix over my bed. It was looked like a witch's, like a coven, you know. I mean, some of the director came in with some actors to audition for some scenes. You know, hi, Richard. And they looked around like I was fucking nuts, you know. But, you know, that's, I had to do that. I mean, I threw myself into that guy totally until we hit the last shot. I told the director, I went, Peter, listen, because, you know, I was only sober about 8 or 9 months, I believe, and I was shaky. And I said, when an actor left the room at the hotel in New York, I said, you know what, you shouldn't, you know, I went into the attics, like, deal, like, you know, we're real grandiose sometimes, or we feel like we have no esteem at all. And that, I mean, that's sort of an addicts kind of deal. And I was right into, like, I don't deserve this. It's, you know, who am I to have a role like this? So I told him, you shouldn't really hire me. I'm an alcoholic, basically. So I'm an alcoholic. And he looked at me and started laughing, looked around the room, this sparse, you know, room, and he said, no kidding. What a shocker, man. You know? And it was so clear that I was, and I think he knew anyway that, you know, that I, so he just really relaxed me, and I did it. And the fact that it's out now and that Peter Cohn and him, you know, worked out whatever they'd work out, you know, I'm just thrilled. I'm just thrilled. I think, you know, rather than it just being like people coming over to me, hey, you know, I had a DUI, and they showed the movie in class, or certainly in rehabs, you know, they send it. And, you know, it was like me sending it to where I went to, you know, I was there briefly in Hazelden. I've done stuff for Hazelden, certainly. I didn't graduate there, but I've sent them stuff and public service announcements for how important it is, I felt. And then I sent them Drunks, and they showed, you know, so I mean, but it was like, wow, why can't this big thing be on TV, you know, why can't it be on DVD? Wow, now Bundle the Nerves, which is Jonathan Gross's title. He came into me, it's interesting, I was doing a show in Caroline's, like coincidentally, which I'll go into in September. And he came to the show, and he came in, and he says, I have to do something with you. I have an idea, right out of the gate, Bundle of Nerves. And I called him, and he called me, and whatever. And he says, what are some of the things you think? And then we started narrowing down things that haven't been out, like Diary, like Drunks, and then a lost special that never was out on DVD that he says, I can make that happen, you know. So, you know, he really was, I owe him a debt for this, you know. He's just really... He's really came through for me. It's, I hate to use the word legacy. It just, I feel like a, you know, 90-year-old comedian. I mean, or a ball player, you know, or a president. But I mean, it really is. And these were really important things for me. And even Magical Misery Tour, which I asked Ringo, who's an old friend of mine, that back in the day in '96, I went, "Do you mind if I you sort of lift the, you know, Magical Misery Tour?" Which I love the Beatles. Like, who doesn't? Yeah. And he says, I don't give a fuck, really, what title you think. It's like really funny. And I realized, why am I asking Ringo this question? It's so stupid. Why would he care? You know, all my titles were like, I'm exhausted, I'm doomed, I'm in pain. It was all these kind of, you know, little jokes. So anyway, you know, the same thing with Magical Misery Tour. You know, it was like, it was the first special, and I had done many of them, sober. And I was really, it was really, and in New York City at the legendary, then legendary Bottom Line, which is no longer there in the Village. And it was a big deal for me to do a special at that place. Springsteen used to play like sets for 5 hours down there in the mid-70s. And so it was a thrill to, I had performed there, but I had never done a special, and it was never seen after it aired. Mm. So, you know, it never was on DVD. So So once again, that's another reason why I'm thrilled about this box set. You know, it's not just like I'm putting in crapola. At least as far as I'm concerned, I'm putting in really important things in my career. Mm-hmm. And if people are fans, then cool. If not, so be it. You know, I'm just glad it's out there.
Going back to Drunks, in the audio commentary, you had mentioned that you had studied Stanislavski, but you weren't formally trained, were you?
Well, I took acting, you know, Stanislavski, in college. And then when I came out to Los Angeles, you know, I'd be hard pressed to remember the names of the coaches, to be frank. But I took improvisational classes. I took some, I took acting classes. I didn't do that much scene study. But you know, I did a lot of reading. I felt for me that I had some semblance of a foundation for method. You know, that was, I was most interested in focusing on that technique, because I thought for me, that it was the easiest to tap into, because that's what I was doing simultaneously on stage at stand up, to tap into these sense memories of my life and turn them into humorous, you know, jokes or premises, and try to be naturally, you know, and real on stage. And you know, that's the deal, you know, you got to be real and believable. I sometimes can make really crazy hyperbolic premises seem real. In fact, the late David Brenner said to me, who was a really brilliant observational humorist and a great friend of mine, said, you make surreal things seem real. And he said, I make real things seem surreal. And that was sort of cool. Because, that's what he did with these observations. Like, how can they do this? How can they put a sign up like that, for example? And it was hilarious. And, you know, and in my case, I would, you know, if I had a tough time at the DMV, I'd be, you know, in the middle of the routine, I'd be dancing with sheep, whatever it is, however I do it. I'm not even quite sure if I'm a hoax sometimes when people are laughing. I think it's just, I think they're just scared that I'm having a breakdown. But I'm sorry, I missed your question. I didn't even answer it.
Well, you actually answered the question that I was setting up, which was basically at some point.
You were setting up for this, and I answered. Oh yes. God, I hope I'm not doing blow anymore.
You're getting ahead of me. No, you're. My feeling was what I did want to find out is, in sort of getting into the method, if you realize to yourself, holy shit, this is stuff I'm already doing.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, hey, listen, that's true. I had, most of the things I did that were quality things, for what it's worth, with the training I had, I got really good reviews and some really great reviews. And I have never had a tremendous amount of opportunity because of my persona as me, being me, same guy. So I understand that. And, of course, when I did Curb, I was literally playing Larry David's buddy. So, even though that was very surreal to do that, and it was acting, nevertheless, just to be believable was important. And I think that whole show pulled that off. And then it's really excruciatingly funny way. And, I think I had just about enough to do what I've done so far. And, I'm not going to play, I'm not going to do Shakespeare in the Park, or I said they had to write Lewis for Abraham Lincoln for sure. But there are roles like early on Drunks that I knew I could handle, and did the director, and it was based on a play by Gary Lennon, and he's a terrific writer, and he was always happy. He thought I added some kind of dimension to, the role, and that's all you can hope for, you know, just to be true to the character, and then you just walk away and see what happens, you know. But I don't know if that answered anything.
Would you do Beckett?
I would do Beckett if it was a new sitcom on on HBO. If I was, you know, an aging pet store owner who was trying to find faith, and you know, I can start pitching it now.
You know, he wanted.
No, I wouldn't Beckett. That was very funny. Now you sound like a high school bully who who's now working for a HuffPo, and you're like, you can't do Beckett, you child. Okay, no. And I'm glad that it was O'Toole, and you know, he was much better.
No, I'm not. I was talking about.
Stop it! You were mocking me. It's fine. It just fuels me for the next show.
That's true. I'm just a terrible person that way. No, I meant Sam Beckett.
Samuel Beckett. Oh, okay. Oh, absolutely. I think I'm thin enough, and I'll just put on a mustache, and you know, show me the soundstage, babe. I'm sorry. I haven't had time to research. You just gave me the role. I was thinking of Gene O'Neill, actually an astonishing American Masters that I love. I've seen it more than a dozen times through the years on O'Neill. And he had that tall, thin, dark, who's darker, who's more amazing in that. In mustache. He looked like, unless I'm confusing him with Howard Hughes right now. Hold on a minute. Get me the photos, honey. You know, mine's going a little bit. Anyway, I don't want to start riffing on this or, you know, you'll miss some relatives' birthdays.
No, because Beckett, I mean, wanted comedians cast in his plays. Definitely waiting for Godot. That
yeah, movie. Right. Well, Steve Martin and Robin did it, and Ben Stiller, young Ben Stiller, in New York City. I went to see them. It's like about 20 years ago. Yeah, I didn't really know that, but I sort of remember reading that or being taught that. But you know, you're such a maven about all these. You know, every drop of the art world. I know. I'm out of my league here.
No, nah, I'm just going on my cliff notes here. Don't worry about it.
Oh, thank goodness.
My copious notes. let me ask you, maybe just to close this up. I mean, if you were given the opportunity, would you want to do more dramatic roles? Is that something that you want to explore more?
In a heartbeat. And in the last 5 or 6 months, I've met with some pretty heavyweight people out here who, as it turns out, were clueless that I had that drive. And when forced to see, you know, certain tapes of me that are not me on camera, you know, they were, you know, it was not a rude awakening, but it was a sort of like an epiphany. Like, oh wow, we're going to try to plug you in as many places. Well, time will tell. But yes, the short answer is yes, and the long answer is, I have always been available. And I think because of the stand-up career, you know, it's been a great journey. But it's just as a quiet little offshoot of it was like, I think that people were so hooked into my stand-up, which is really me, that they sort of like were blinded by other things I wanted, and why should they care and why should they know? So yeah, you know, the more I'm hopeful in the next decade for sure that I get some really, even if it's just one wonderful role that I could really, you know, live with for 4 or 5 years, it would be a great thing. It would be a great thing for every actor. So, being selfish, I'm just, you know, it's just by contrast to most of my career, you know, it's just worth mentioning, I guess, you know, on the heels of this box set, that sure, that's what I'm looking more for that. I mean, it would be nothing better for me than to, you know, be home, you know, and drive to the studio or go on location, you know, and do a real edgy, dark role. And then when I'm off, to go on the road and just explode on stage because, you know, I haven't performed, say, in 2 months or whatever. Mm. That would be the ideal. And it has happened from time to time, but not on a long, you know, 3-4 year run. So that's one of, sort of a little mini goal. We all have little goals. So but thanks for asking.
Oh, no problem. Just out of curiosity, I mean, when you got into Anything But Love, at that point in your career, goals, was did you ever imagine romantic lead as part of your career goals?
Not on that level. Just quietly meeting someone at a bar, going, "Want to come home?" You know. That's not in front of 30,000 people with a 29-year-old, you know, Jamie Lee Curtis. I mean, that was a shocker to, even though it came in 10th, the first show. I don't want to go into the history of that show. We got sort of robbed out of a fifth season after we were picked up by ABC, and then for some, well, whatever. It was a great run, and but, you know, what you just said, you know, it was funny because the first year or so we weren't lovers on the show, mm-hmm. of course, only, obviously. And well, it's not obvious on show business, but she was married. I was friends with Chris and Jamie. At any rate, when I would be on the road, like particularly Cabby, say, "Hey, Lewis," because I'd already done a lot of specials. I've been on TV, and you know, I've done like 30 or 40 Letterman by that time. And Carson and all the rest. And they said, "Why'd you make love with her already? What's your problem?" I said, "It's not a problem. I don't have a sexual problem." You know, they had no idea. Well, you know, they thought it was, you know, people take things that it's real. But it started to get to me, and I would quietly made the writing staff and the producers crazy. I would fax them, like, "Come on, when am I going to have intercourse on television?" Crazy people are hounding me. You know, it fell on deaf ears for 2 years. And finally, you know, I was so frightened that first love scene in front of the studio audience. That is just, oh, God. I just thought of everything that can go wrong. Am I drift? Oh, God. But, you know, Jamie Lee was so natural and so real, and I just prayed that I could, you know, I was making believe I was in bed with, you know, like, a scarecrow. I can get through it without, you know, being on the cover of, you know, the New York Post. Lewis tragically gets, you know, Lewis gets erection during taping, out of the business, you know. The doctors came, and while they're taking him into the ambulance, he's apologized for the erection, but he says, "Look, he's a method actor, and he couldn't help it." You know, and Chris Guest said it was okay. He was flattered. And he bailed him out of jail. And, you know, I mean, anything could have happened. But it turned out I was cool. I was cool with it. But so when we used to tape Fridays, and then we get the script for the read-through on Mondays. Mm-hmm. And I would, man, on Friday night, I was so happy we were done. And I'd be in my dressing room, and I would zip through the next episode and see. And I would see, like, second scene, Richard and Jamie, you know, our characters are, you know, making out on the sofa. Well, yeah, you know, because, I mean, there's nothing, I mean, even though it's done by, you know, it's certainly on filmmaking, love scene, this is hardly, you know, those kind of films, you know, but it is by the numbers. But, you know, but when you're sitting on a couch making out with someone, you know, and it's not like, you know, a lot of like, all right, now put, you know, like, you know, heavy sexual content, it's fun. And there's no question. You know, it's fun. And, you know, my wife, my wonderful wife, Joy, she always laughs when we watch a film. She says, "Yeah, tell me they're not having a good..." No, I say, they are, but, you know, and then I started to think back in the old days when I was just sort of a, you know, a lover of everything, you know. You know, there was a lot of women I met, you know, it was almost impossible not to, you know, not to really... you know, get involved, you know, outside of the filming, the shooting, when you're close on the show or the movie. It's just that simple. And I let no one tell you otherwise, you know, particularly on location. You're away from the world, you know, it's like a family, the whole crew and cast. And it's like a, you know, it's really euphoric. you know, and then people, you know, people leave and they go off to the next project and it starts all over again, you know, particularly for actors who act all the time, mm-hmm. you know, it's by contrast as a stand-up, which is really at the core of who my universe. I've been on the road for 44 years and most of the time. So that's a whole other trip. That has nothing, you know, that's really tedious, but something that I wanted. And but in terms of relationships, I mean, and or meeting people, it's not as convenient and comfortable and safe. You know, when you're just out in every city, you bounce around, it's like crazy. So, you know, luckily, I sobered up on a lot of areas in my life and calmed down for the last 20 years. And it's the best thing I ever did for myself, bottoming out in 94.
So, Richard, thank you very much for talking with us.
Yeah, it was my pleasure, man. And, you know, initially I was a little self-conscious because, you know, you were throwing out a little, you know, little taste of your brilliance and you just put me in a corner like a child. So I put my dunce cap on that was given to me by my parents right after I was born. So, but I think I handled myself well, given how, you know, powerfully brilliant you are. So I hope I don't, you know, I hope I'm not, I didn't do damage to my family's reputation or me.
Trust me, you came out fine. As far as me, it's all a facade. It's all pre-scripted.
You don't have cue cards, do you?
No, I don't. I can't afford that yet. So,
well, I just want everyone to know that that I didn't have anything told me. It wasn't like a quiz show scandal. I had no idea what you've been asked. And it's a pleasure to talk to you, my friend.
Thank you very much. Before we go,
Dan Persons, Private Eye. What you do is you go around and find dumb people. I just say, I know more about Truffaut than you.
My work is done here. On to the next gig.
Dan Persons, next week, he talks about the silent era to a group of young kids who don't know it existed. What a great character. You just go around and demean people with your intelligence. I'll be glad to play you if you can sell that. Dan Persons, Humiliator. Dun, 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 dun.
Okay.
All right, Dan. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Where am I going to see this humiliation? By the way,
this is going to be
Huffington Post.
This is going to be Huffington Post. It'll also be on a website, Mighty Movie Podcast, and probably first or second week of September, it'll be going up.
Beautiful.
Okay.
All right, buddy. Take care of yourself.
Okay.
Be well.
Just quickly,
bye.
One more very quick
thank
thing.
You,
my wife and I are big fans. Oh.
Thank you.
Okay, just wanted to let you know.
Oh, that was it? That was a throwaway?
Yeah, that was a throwaway. Yeah, maybe I should have led
this
with that.
This is another quick thing. No, that's cool. I just wanted to tell you this. I didn't want to say it, but I'm a big fan of you and your wife.
Oh, I'll let her know.
We're on the same we're on the same plane. But thank you. I appreciate it. I'll end on a real note. I appreciate it. And thank you for your time, man.
Thank you
really
very
mean.
Much. Take it easy, man.
All right, buddy. Take care of yourself.
Whew. Wow, Richard Lewis, huh? And yeah, he called me out on my film school pretensions. That's fair. If you're going to get taken down by the best, I say. Thank you for that, Richard. So, Richard Lewis, Bundle of Nerves, the two-disc set featuring Diary of a Young Comic, The Magical Misery Tour, Drunks, and House of a Lifetime, plus audio commentaries, and specially shot intros by Lewis for each film, is available now. It's over at Amazon and other fine home video purveyors, I am sure. If you love Richard Lewis, you've got to get this. And while I've got you, let me just remind you that if you're in the New York City, tri-state area, you can hear my movie reviews on Hour of the Wolf. Every Thursday morning at 1:30 a.m., some call it Wednesday night, it's more accurate to call it Thursday morning, over on WBAI 99.5 FM. If you can't stay up that late, the full show is archived over at WBAI.org, and I'm archiving the reviews themselves at MightyMoviePodcast.com. And coming soon, maybe very soon, maybe sooner than anyone even knows, the return of the Temple of Bad, when we'll be talking about the mind-boggling family fantasy, and I use that term advisedly, a talking cat. That'll be on MightyMoviePodcast.com and CFQOnline.com as well. And HuffPost, of course, always on HuffPost. And if you want to write me, send the email to Dan@MightyMoviePodcast.com. That's it. Thanks for listening. I'm Dan Persons, your host and producer. This show is copyright 2014 Upstart Company NYC. All rights reserved. No unauthorized duplication permitted.